Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Dialogue Out Loud series. I'm Taylor Petrie, editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Today, we're excited to have with us Noel Carmack, assistant professor of art at Utah State University Eastern. In his fascinating article, Correlating Orthodoxy and Style, Institutionally Approved Christ-Centered Art in LDS Visual Resources and Meeting Houses, 1990 to 2021, Carmack explores the history of LDS art correlation, building on some of his earlier work. In this latest piece, Carmack discusses the past 30 years, focusing on chapels, the internet age, and updated handbooks in these years. Noel, welcome. It's so nice to talk to you about your work.
Thank you, Taylor. It's a really a good pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about that earlier BYU Studies article. What did that article show? And why did you decide to update it with this more recent research?
Well, I think a lot has happened since that article was published. But when I researched that article, I was really interested in how not only did grassroots membership view images of Christ, but I really wanted to see how the institution chose or selected images and used them in their official publications. And it really started back when I was an undergraduate student at Utah State. I did a folklore paper on legends surrounding the painting that Del Parsons, the famous red-robed Christ, and I researched the legends surrounding that painting. So I interviewed a lot of students and non-students as well, but what stories they had heard about it. And so that article was started from that initial folklore paper, and it grew from there.
So by now it's several decades old. And so you've mentioned that, that things have changed since then. So in the 1990 to 2021 period that you look at in this article, what are some of the big changes in the world and the church that are going on that led to some revised correlation in those years?
Well, I think that going back to about 1995, 96, we had several scholars who were publishing on the visual culture of religion, David Morgan and others. We had Colleen McDaniel at University of Utah, who wrote a book on material Christianity. Other scholars who were doing work on material culture. And so we had some publications, a significant article that was published in the Salt Lake Tribune about images of Christ. And it sort of brought up this idea that images, particularly Christ-centered images, have an impact on our piety, how we worship. And so my findings in that initial article sort of led me to look at what images of Christ existed. So since that time, since that article was published, we've seen not only the growth of the internet, the church's web presence, and just an explosion of imagery, particularly Christ-centered imagery. And I was really interested in sort of documenting what the church had done since 95, 96. And I found that it's become more institutionally controlled or correlated, to use the church's term, where images are vetted by committees. Church authorities will review the images and approve them. And then, of course, if you read the article, you'll find that very recently, the church issued a selection of 22 images that are approved and allowable for use in church meeting houses. So
some of these are produced by LDS artists, some are historical resources and so on. Is that correct?
Right, right. So we have a number of LDS artists who are, or I would say are favored in terms of the way that they depict Christ. They depict him in a more realistic way and showing his sensitive side, so forth. But we also have historical imagery, you know, things like works by Harry Anderson, who was a non-LDS artist. There were other, Carl Bloch is a hugely favorite artist in Mormon visual culture. So those images have remained, but we've also got a few that are LDS artist produced as well.
So before we got down to those 21 in the recent
22.
You described that there was, you know, in chapels more diverse art, in on the internet there was more diverse art, in church publications even there was more diverse art. Why do you think that the church decided to exercise so much more oversight and control over this in these years?
I really think that it was really for cohesion, for orthodoxy, as it states in the title of my piece, that they could control the image of the church through this visual culture. And as we've seen with President Nelson, Russell M. Nelson has made sweeping changes. We could argue that they're pretty significant changes in what church membership and really official publications and so forth can do, with number one, the use of Mormon or disallowing or disapproving of the term, but also in the imagery, they are very careful about what images can be used in church meeting houses, just so that they can be unified in their message, that it can be cohesive, and that they sort of speak with, or in this case, visualize the church with one voice or one it's a single unified voice in portraying the church visually.
So you describe in the article that the Priesthood Correlation Program takes this role in vetting the art. And one of the fascinating things that you publish here is the notes that you get to these to their review, not just of the art that gets approved, but a lot of the art that doesn't get approved as well. And I found it as a reader so interesting and so fascinating and kind of shocking in some cases, their takes on some of these pieces. Can you describe a little bit about who was on this committee, their method of selection, and what were some of the things that you discovered in those notes?
Well, in my initial research for this, I discovered that the Priesthood Executive Council had conducted a survey of images. I believe I'd have to go back to the source. I think it was 349 images that were examined, many of which are non-LDS images of Christ. But we had several church authorities who were members of this review committee, Dallin H. Oaks,
I think Holland was on it.
Yeah. Let me look here. Let me go back to my notes, but yeah. We had several, church authorities who were on the committee, and, they would make comments in the margins of their review. So they were looking through the images, and trying to find it here on the, and they would mark, there was a three-tiered ranking system, basically to use or not to use, or maybe use with caution or edit. And so they would go through and they would rank each image. And then in some instances, they would put down a little comment down in the margin. And this is where it was really fascinating to see what their perceptions were just based on those little comments that they made. Some of them were based on the masculinity or effeminity in appearance to of the image that they might have objected to. Let's see. I found it here. The survey was done by Dallin Oaks, Jeffrey Holland, Robert Hales, Jack Goslin, Jay Jensen, and John Madsen. And the ranking system or the ranking system was use where appropriate, use caution, or do not use. And again, some of those comments in the margins were quite fascinating to me. So
it was an all-male committee, all of a relatively certain age and church status that sort of get to decide what is good art about Jesus for the entire church.
And that's right.
You mentioned masculinity, the perceived masculinity of the Jesus that's represented is important. I think you also talk a little bit about realism. Can you tell us a little bit about like what that is and why that's a value for church art?
Well, I've argued both in this article and in the BYU Studies article that Latter-day Saints really look at or use realistic imagery to sort of underscore or support their literal view of the scriptures. So Latter-day Saints view the scriptures as very literal and that these are historical figures. So we expect to look at imagery that is more realistic in appearance. We want to see imagery that is of narrative in subject matter, narrative and realistic in quality. So when the reviewers, the members of this committee, were going through each of these images, they were looking for things that were very doctrinal or that corresponded to church doctrine that fit well within this view, this literal view of the scriptures.
And it's an artistic style that has a particular genealogy as well. It's also a particular like European early modern style as
right.
well. Is that accurate?
I would say that early modern representations are Renaissance, post-Renaissance, where you have paintings, images that are modeled that have a representational quality that no other period, you know, Byzantine or even if we go to modern, postmodern artists don't achieve with their work. The church leadership wanted to see more representational, realistic imagery of Christ, and then you see in this selection of approved images that they're all very representational.
You discuss particular artists like Harry Anderson and Del Parsons. How do you think their work reflects the institutional ideals of the church? This is work that's commissioned by the church, is my understanding. And maybe you could talk about other pieces as well.
Harry Anderson was a favorite. Carl Bloch was another. We had others by Grant Robney Clausen and other painters in the 60s and 70s. These particular artists, a couple of them were actually commissioned. Kenneth Riley was another one who did work that was Book of Mormon related, or he did a couple that were that depicted church historical events, but these guys were non LDS. They were non Mormon, and I suspect that, you know, it was very easy for the graphic arts department to direct, you know, them and to do exactly what they wanted. And of course, there were, you know, there was, I think, a long period of time where we didn't have a core of really good illustrative artists that did work that was acceptable. But these two or three artists were really, I would say, fit well within the church's archetype of Christ, what they wanted the church members to see.
So we've talked a little bit about how the Correlation Committee kind of imposes this perspective of what, you know, good art is, or what the kind of institutionally approved art is going to be here, and how that affects, like, the how that sort of ripples out to the church. How do you think that this approval process for Christ-centered images impacts artistic expression inside LDS communities?
It's an interesting question. You know, the church commissions artists all the time for the church, the temples, the interior, to decorate the interiors of the temples and so forth. And so they're very encouraging of artists. They've established a longstanding art competition, an international art competition. So they encourage diverse depictions, but in terms of the official sort of official portrayal of Christ, they're very strict or very particular about how they want him to show. They don't want abstractions or otherworldly beings shown in these images, wings or depictions of the supernatural or those sorts of things that you might see in, you know, the early modern images or Renaissance images, things like halos, wings, anything like that that is supernatural and beyond our sort of natural vision, right? Our natural view of things.
So it's so interesting the way that, you know, just the way that LDS artists, then you're sort of absorbing these values, these ideals about what art is from the church, that then affects right. their own depictions, right?
Yeah, right. So I think what's the most disconcerting to me is that although we have committees that are informed, people in the art, you know, the art community within the church, curators, art scholars who comprise these committees, who make these thoughtful selections, but as it goes up the chain of vetting or the chain of command up to the upper echelons of church leadership, they are the ones who actually make the selections. And, you know, these people are more, you know, businessmen and really don't have that kind of a background to maybe make a thoughtful critique or a thoughtful selection of works that are maybe not or maybe don't fit within the desired parameters of how they want Christ to be depicted.
Well, your analysis of the Priesthood Correlation Committee notes, as I mentioned, was one of the most interesting things for me. There are so many juicy insights and great analysis in this piece. You were telling me a little bit before we started recording about maybe a little bit of controversy about how you came into those and how they ended up getting published here with us in Dialogue.
Well, initially, I used my research. I had been shown some documents in the Visual Resources Library, this Priesthood Executive Council survey, and also was accompanied by a couple of memos where I got quite a bit of information. And so so initially, it really wasn't, they weren't meant for my eyes. And so to cite them was a little bit controversial. And so that in that first article, they didn't appear in the notes, but they do appear here in this dialogue piece. I've had, you know, I presented this article in abbreviated form at the Mormon History Association in Logan last year. And when I cited the survey, you know, a number of people came up and asked, you know, wondered how they could access it. How can we find this and look at it? And so I really don't know that that's going to be made available to researchers, or, you know, it's an internal document. So it does exist. I have my notes, but there's a strong possibility that the scholars will not be able to access it unless they're given approval.
Well, we are so grateful that you made that research available to all of us. I think it makes such an important contribution and so insightful about why certain things were chosen and not others, and what are the criteria that they're using that they're not necessarily explaining publicly. And I'm also just incredibly grateful for academic freedom and for places like Dialogue where we can publish that kind of stuff. So thanks so much for your research and your contributions on this.
I should mention to Taylor that John Turner, who did a really outstanding book a few years ago, I think it's entitled Jesus, a biography, Mormon Jesus,
yeah,
right. He and I communicated. He approached me about my research, and he actually cites the research there. He actually asked me about using the sources. And I said, well, just give it a little bit of time and I'm going to come out with it. And so here we have the result in this piece in Dialogue. So I'm really grateful for, like you said, I'm grateful for academic freedom and the ability to have these things published.
Yeah, it's such an important piece, and especially focusing on modern LDS art understandings, is really, an area of scholarship that I think we could definitely see more of. And so thank you so much for joining us today, Noel. And it's been a huge pleasure to talk to you about your work.
Okay, thanks so much. I appreciate you communicating and having me on this podcast. Thanks.
We hope that our listeners have enjoyed and learned something new. If you'd like to learn more, check out Noel Carmack, Correlating Orthodoxy and Style, Institutionally Approved Christ-Centered Art in LDS Visual Resources and Meeting Houses 1990 to 2021 in the winter 2023 issue of Dialogue, and explore other resources on this topic there. To our listeners, thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends and colleagues, and don't forget to leave us a review or get in touch with any comments and questions. We hope you'll tune in for future episodes of our podcast. Please subscribe and rate the show, and be sure to check out the whole range of shows in the Dialogue Podcast Network. Thanks.
I'm going to take a risk in this ad by saying the word holiness right here in the very first sentence. That's risky because the word can trigger all kinds of positive or negative feelings. I mean, sometimes I'm afraid to call something holy because it makes things feel sort of unrelatable or like disconnected from everyday life. And really, I mean, that's too bad because the word's actually related to wholeness and healthfulness, which suggests that maybe we can learn to find holiness in places we never really thought to look before. I'm talking about holiness like a fire. It can warm, but it can also burn. You might get smoke in your eyes, but the flickering flames are also really beautiful. If this kind of holiness sounds appealing, you should check out Fireside with Blair Hodges. It's a podcast featuring writers, artists, and activists who can help expand your concept of holiness to include the gritty, earthy stuff of everyday life. Come fan the flames of your curiosity at Fireside with Blair Hodges, part of the Dialogue Podcast Network. Available at firesidepod.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.